The following is the third part of a 15-part special teaching by Dr. Kenneth Boa on paradigm spirituality.
We started a series on what I call paradigm spirituality. It's not a pair of dimes, but a paradigm. It's kind of a buzzword, I guess. It's been used a lot. In fact, Jerry Peterson gave me this little cartoon with a doctor with his patient here. And underneath it, it says, "I'm afraid the doctor says you've had a paradigm shift," as if that's some kind of a disease. But it's such a common notion, a paradigm shift. But I still think it can be used as a tool for our understanding. If we understand what that means and what the implications are, I think it can be very profound. I define a paradigm as a way of seeing things, as a way of seeing. And this way of seeing the world and what's around us is based on implicit or explicit rules that'll shape your perspective. So there are going to be rules. The rules by which you play will shape the way you see the world. You may not even know what they are. They may be implicit. Or you may know what they are. They may be explicit. But the point is simply this, that you will have a way of viewing the world, whether you've articulated it or not. You will view the world from a certain perspective, a certain orientation. And my counsel to people is that you become consciously aware of what that perspective is. The idea of objective neutrality is a myth. No one comes to life with a total objectivity. That's an illusion that sometimes I fear some scholars deceive themselves into thinking. But the fact is that we all have a bias or a point of view. And it would be well for us to evaluate that paradigm that we embrace so that we can make mid-course adjustments if necessary. Now, what's meant by a paradigm shift, then, is when the rules or boundaries change. Something's caused you, something's forced you to change your way of seeing. The rules have changed. You no longer see things from the perspective you had before. But now you see the same things, perhaps, but in a new way, in a new orientation. We've all seen this, haven't we, with optical illusions, where you look at the illusion in one point of view and you can't see it, but then you point it out and suddenly you can see it. You didn't see it before. I have one, for example, that's a bunch of kind of dark and white areas, and many people do not see that it's a cow, but because it looks vague enough. But once you see the cow, you can't help but see it anymore. You see the point here? And there are some of these paradigms where you look at it and you see it coming out and then all of a sudden it's coming at you. And some of those are reversible. You can't see them both at the same time. So some of these are one way. Once you see it, you can't help but see it. But other paradigms are reversible. You can flip-flop back and forth. I'm going to be talking about the temporal versus the eternal as a reversible paradigm, I fear. It's not as though once you embrace the eternal perspective, you'll always have it, because it's easy to kind of go back into the orientation that you had before, even if you're a follower of Christ. Now, the most celebrated example of a paradigm shift, of course, is the Copernican revolution in astronomy. Most of you have read about that and heard about it, that until the time of Copernicus, the reigning paradigm was Ptolemy's geocentric system. Geocentric, what does that mean? The Earth is the center of the solar system, and everything goes around us. The planets and so forth go around us. It was based upon, I believe, a fallacious understanding of Scripture. Scripture never taught that. But people suppose that if the earth is the pinnacle of God's creative work, it must be the center of everything. There was no warrant for really buying into that notion from a biblical point of view. But many people just held that, and it almost became a kind of a dogmatic notion that led to some trouble. Because here's what happened then. For centuries then, they viewed the solar system in this way, but there were many observations that simply didn't fit that model. One of those observations is if you looked at Saturn and Jupiter, its apparent motion in the sky as the weeks would go by is that it's called retrograde motion. Saturn would be moving against the backdrop of the stars, and all of a sudden it would stop. And it would go backwards this way, and then it would stop and continue forward. They didn't know what to make of that, because why would Saturn, if it's going around the Earth, do such a crazy thing in Jupiter and so forth? You see the problem. But instead of revising their way of seeing, they came up with a clever system to account for it called epicycles. And epicycles were little epicycles within the orbit of these planets that somehow could account for why it went that way. And they got, and that even didn't work, so they had to get even more sophisticated methods. And what's happening is they're cobbling together a theory that doesn't work, but they're still holding on to the old paradigm. What happens in the paradigm shift is when the data eventually forces you, whether you know it or not, suddenly you have a shift and suddenly you see it with new eyes. You ever have an experience like that? The fact is that coming to faith in Christ is often that kind of a thing for many people. Many people do not hear the gospel the first time. In fact, very few people do. You've got to hear this message again and again and again. I've been in situations where many, many folks who are in a class that I teach, perhaps, may not know or understand the difference between knowing about Jesus and trusting in Him. Having an intellectual assent, sure, they can recite the creeds and all that, but they never understood what it meant to know Him. And suppose I taught, for example, through the book of John or the book of Romans. Eventually, as time would go on, all of a sudden, a light would dawn. It might be several teachings, but suddenly a coherent way of seeing emerged whereby they could now see that this is what it really means to be a follower of Jesus. This is what it means. It's not just trusting, believing in a proposition, but rather, it's trusting in a person. Huge difference. Because Christianity is not a religion, it's a relationship. Bottom line there is that it is not a matter of propositional truth, though I do not downplay propositional truth. Propositions are extremely important, and the Bible is filled with them. But propositions as ends in themselves do not work. Revelation was given not just to inform us, but to transform us. And that is why Revelation always demands a response. You must respond. It is a series of propositions which invite a personal response, not just cognitive, but volitional. You see the idea here? It's not merely a matter of believing about Jesus. It's a matter, really, of trusting in Jesus. Some of you have heard the illustration that I used, the best one I've run across to explain that difference is the Niagara Falls illustration. How many of you have heard that illustration? A few of you have. It's in my book, I'm Glad You Asked, although I have to change it and I'm Glad You Asked because it doesn't end well, and I'll explain why that doesn't end well. In this story, and it's pretty apocryphal, most of these details here, but the story goes that in the late 19th century, a French tightrope walker by the name of Blondin came across the ocean and came to the Niagara Falls to accomplish something that had never been done. There was a lot of publicity because they brought this 1,100 feet cable. They extended that across the falls from the Canadian side to the United States side, and he was to go and walk across a rather dramatic event since he was about 160 feet above the water. And one fall is it. And there was a large crowd that was gathered, and according to the stories, and there are different accounts, he went across successfully and then got a wheelbarrow and put a weight in it and rolled it back, which impressed the crowd to no end. Then he asked them, how many of you believe I could take one of you and put you in this wheelbarrow and roll you across? And everybody said, sure, you can do it. But then he asked for volunteers, and no one got in. And it's good as far as it goes, because it clearly does illustrate the difference between intellectual belief and personal trust, doesn't it? But then it occurred to me, there's something wrong with that illustration. What's wrong with that illustration? What do you think? It doesn't quite work.
It's not true you're dead.
What's that?
It's not true you're going to 160 feet.
No, that's pretty true. You've fallen. What's that?
Trusting in the weakness of
mankind. There's even something different. Here's what I concluded was wrong. Why would anyone get in the wheelbarrow? The fact is, okay, you can get in the wheel, but why would you do such a dopey thing? Do you see my point there? Sure, you believe it intellectually. What's that?
There's got to be a goal.
There has to be a purpose or a reason for getting in that wheelbarrow. So here's what I did. Since it's apocryphal anyway, I embellished it even more. Here's what I did. I imagined that there was a thick forest behind the spectators, and that suddenly the forest caught fire and there was no way of escape from backwards. Now things get interesting. Suddenly the rules change, don't they? Now there are only four options. for the crowd. Option number one, I'm not here and it's not hot. Just deny your situation and you'll be burned to a crisp. You see the point there? You'll be burned to a crisp. That's not a good option, is it? Second option is to try to take your chances by plunging in the raging waters. Not a good option. Third option is to try to go across the tightrope yourself. Not very good. Not likely you can make it. Now suddenly the fourth option of getting in the wheelbarrow looks very attractive. And furthermore, I want to stress this, because it's a good analogy. It's not as if it's a leap in the dark. It's a step into the light. And the reason why it's a step into the light is because he's already demonstrated that he could go the other side and come back. What's going to the other side and coming back? It's raising from the dead, you see. The resurrection is going to the other side and then coming back from the other side is a demonstrable evidence that, in fact, Jesus is who he claims to be, and that by entrusting myself to his life, getting in that wheelbarrow is really a reasonable thing to do, and choosing not to get in that wheelbarrow is a choice, in fact, to either ignore him or to reject him. But let me tell you, there's only two options, because to ignore him is covert rejection. At the end of the day, you only have two choices. The two thieves illustrate, or the two criminals on the two sides of Christ illustrate the only choices you've got. One is that of accepting him. Remember, they were both kind of mocking him. They were both kind of going along with the crowd and saying, come on down from the cross, that sort of notion. But then one of them came to realize, wait a minute now. We are suffering justly for us, but this man has done no wrong. And then he turns to Jesus. And what does he say to him, the one malefactor? What does he say? Remember me, he says, when you go into your Father's kingdom. What is Jesus' response? It's a wonderful word from the cross. Truly I say to you, this day you will be with me in paradise. Isn't that a great response? Now the opposite response is that of rejecting him. In Mel Gibson's film, there's a very intriguing moment where you see the absolute hardening of the other thieves' heart, of the criminal's heart. He reaches a point where it's evident that he has finally reached the point of no return. It's at that point that Gibson artistically tries to illustrate that spiritual blindness by using physical blindness, and that's why he has the bird pluck out the eyes. It's gruesome, but it's an illustration of a spiritual reality. You see the point there? And the point is this, that you only have two choices at the end of the day. Hey, I didn't ask to be born. Why do you have this? That's not what you deal with where you are. You know, the fact is that whether you like it or not, not to choose is to choose. You have no option. A choice will be made. And it would be well for us then to at least step into the light rather than just to kind of grope in the darkness. And this is why I always encourage people, if they're not believers in Jesus, at least make an intelligent, informed decision about him before you decide to accept him or reject him. What do I mean by that? I mean, why don't you read the Gospels for yourself, or at least the Gospel of John? I even have a little Gospel of John all by itself. It's just a very simple, thin little thing, so it's not daunting. It's not like giving them a whole New Testament, you see. And I give it to the person and say, here, read this. Why don't you hear for yourself, firsthand rather than second or third hand, about this Jesus? And then you can have a better basis for making a decision about him. If I have him there, that's where I want him. Because now I've got them directly exposed to the power of the Word of God, and that's where I want them to be at the end. And exposed directly, not indirectly, to the teachings, the unique teachings and the unique life of this one, the God-man. So that's a paradigm shift that's necessary in our lives to hear it and suddenly to make an understanding of the shift between believing about him, reciting the creeds, and suddenly realizing that's not enough. I need to trust in him. It's the difference between a religion and a relationship. That's a shift. So what eventually took place then was Copernicus, going back to our original example, concluded that the best and most consistent way to deal with the observations was to conclude that it is a heliocentric solar system. Helios, sun. The sun's at the center, not a geocentric solar system. And so what we now have here is a totally different understanding. Instead of living in a terrestrial system, we live in a solar system. That's why it's called the solar system. It's not the terrestrial system. And this was something that he knew would be troublesome. So he published his views posthumously because he realized that such a radical shift could meet with a great and hostile response, especially by those in the original, in the religious establishment. And so he actually had his papers published concerning the systems, the orbital systems of the planets, published posthumously. Let me give you another example of a paradigm shift, and a few of you may remember this. Henry, you may remember this. This happened, I'm going to guess it was about 1990. It was before, actually, it was while we were meeting at the YMCA. One morning, I got up and exactly an hour late, forgot about the time change and so on. What was interesting about this getting up an hour late was that my clock said one time, you know, I figured I needed to get up, let's say, at 5:30 or 6 o'clock. And even though it was actually 6:30, my mind said it was 5:30. You see my point here? And really, there was a lot of evidence that would cause me to begin to get suspicious. It was a lot lighter than usual. It seemed to be brighter out than normal. And I just put that aside because I know I'm leaving in time to get there by 7 o'clock. Then I get in my car. You know, there's a lot more traffic than usual, you know, and it is a lot brighter out, but there's a tremendous amount of traffic for this hour of the day. I have evidence surrounding me, and all these things that increasingly indicated that I was an hour late, I refused to see it because I bought into that old paradigm. Then I get to the study, and they're all standing up, and they're praying together, and I say, "Isn't that nice?" That they're all having a prayer before we begin our meeting. And even then, it doesn't dawn on me. And only when they start to break up and leave does it dawn on me that I may be an hour late. You see, it took all that, and all of a sudden, the paradigm shift, in spite of all the evidence to the contrary. You see how I mean? You hold tenaciously to your old way of seeing. And it takes an awful lot of evidence to force you. And it's called cognitive dissonance, a discrepancy between what you believe and what's out there. You see? And finally, there reaches a point where you can no longer buy the old paradigm. Mine was when we started leaving, and I realized that, do you remember that? That was a bizarre, Archie, you remember that? Well, I didn't have a clue. He shakes his head. And I didn't have a clue. We never did it this way before. It means we won't do it again. So there's a refusal, a stubborn refusal to really adapt to the needs of our time. You don't want to change the gospel message, but you do feel that you need to adapt in a way that is relevant and apropos for our time. So without dumbing it down, there's a tension there to being relevant on the one hand, but not dumbing it down on the other. I don't ever believe in making it so simple, put the cookies such on such a low shelf that they really dumb down the gospel and make the terms of discipleship much more minimal than they really are. I never see Jesus doing that. But that's an interesting reality we have. So any other thoughts on that paradigm shift? Yes, John?
In leaving the burning forest to go on the other side, you want to be going to something instead of just from something. So on the other side, if you picture Christ with his outstretched arms or maybe releasing dancing virgins or something, at least you got something on the side that you're going to.
Dancing virgins. Where did that come from? Dancing virgins. Don, don't ask. I'm not gonna recognize you anymore. Does anyone else have a comment or a question? Yes, Barry.
Is it possible to go from cognitive to relational unless we have our own personal Red Sea experience? Or put it another way, does God engineer our experiences so that we have something?
Yeah, it's called sovereign foundations, and God sovereignly produces a concept, a awareness of need. No one will come to the gospel without an awareness of need. And so it may well be the pains or struggles or disappointments of life. Very rarely will a person come to faith when everything's going their way. There is such a thing as the happy pagan. Happy pagans are around. As long as their life seems to be in general order, they do not listen to the disappointment of their heart. Deep inside, they know this is not all it was cracked up to be. but on the, they live on the surface of life, so that they fail to really listen to their heart, and they suppose that positions and possessions and all the accoutrements of this fleeting world will be enough to sustain them, and they've been rewarded with a good measure of success in this world and those kinds of things. If relationships are going reasonably well, you see my point, such a person can reach the point of arrogance where they suppose, who needs this? I don't need a crutch. Christianity is just a crutch for emotionally weak people. One of the basic objections. I want to tell you, we don't need a crutch, we need a cure. The fact is that crutch won't do it. You need a cure. The scriptures tell us that the heart is desperately wicked, and really that our best deeds, our best actions fall short, really, of the grace of God. That we all fall short. And until we realize that, that we need a heart transplant, because Jesus says from the heart of man, not external, from the heart of man proceed the evil thoughts and the adulteries and the pride and all these forms of sin, both sins of the flesh and sins of the spirit. Where do they come from, Jesus says? They proceed from the heart. And they, so what comes from within defiles the man, not from without. If that's true, then how would you suppose that you could possibly earn your way to a living relationship with God if your very heart is problematic? Mm-hmm. You see, can you change your own heart? You see my point? It defeats the possibility of merit and good works. It's impossible. So when a person finally comes to that acknowledgement, then they realize they need a heart transplant. The old heart won't do. And it's not something you can do. It'd be like trying to perform heart transplant surgery on yourself. You got the old heart here, and you start trying to stick it in. Won't work. So the point here, I know that some dentists actually have done these extractions from themselves. They've actually done root canals on themselves with mirrors. This is crazy. But it has been done. I actually saw it, and it was gruesome to watch, I have to tell you. To do a root canal on yourself is not a smart thing to do. I guess he didn't trust any other dentists. David, did you ever... You don't do root canals on yourself. Good. I'm glad to hear that you don't do it. In any case... that's what bootstrap theology is. You're trying to grab your bootstraps and pull yourself up into the air. It won't work very well. And that's why the uniqueness of the gospel is this paradigm shift from moving away from the standard notion that virtually the whole world embraces, that coming into a relationship with God or with ultimate reality is a matter of works. To move away from that and to grasp that it's not works at all, but grace. Not of works that anyone should boast. That it is not something we can achieve. It is something that God must reach down, bridge the gap, pay the price, and make it possible for us to enter into relationships whereby He can be just and still forgive us. Someone pays the price. This is unique to Christianity. You will not find it in any of the world's religions, nor will you find it, interestingly enough, in the various cults. Even the so-called Christian cults. They're all work systems. Every one is a work system. This ought to tell you something, shouldn't it? That there's only one in the world that's grace through faith, and all the rest are works. What does that tell you? It ought to tell you that that's the religion of human aspiration. The delusion, somehow, that God's not quite as perfect as we might think, and that we can bring Him down to our level. Or the other delusion is that we're better than we think. And we can bring ourselves, or maybe a combination of both, whereby the gap is not so great that you cannot bridge it. You see the point here? That's an illusion. This is where I say the real difference is this. The real difference is not to compare ourselves with one another, because frankly, we might look around at each other and we might say, hey, if God's fair, I'll get in because I'm better than most people. Most people, by the way, think they're better than most people, you see. But the fact is, half the people you know are below average. But nobody would say they're below average, you see. So I'm better than most people. So we compare ourselves with other people, and we say, hey, I'm God. So they got this crazy notion, he's got some kind of a cosmic scale, you see. And if your good works outweigh your bad, you're in. If your bad works outweigh your good, you're out, right? Now think about this. So, I mean, is this really worthy of a God of holiness? Suppose you got 51% good works and 49% bad works. Okay, that means you're 49% evil. And then you're going to heaven? And God says, okay, just watch it. Don't let me catch you doing that. You go, yeah, this is hell. This would be another extension of work of the planet again. It's nuts. Or we might suppose some people have arbitrary standards. Every work system does. Well, you know, what's good enough to make it? We might suppose, okay, maybe if you do try your hardest, you see, do your best, God will let you in, right? Well, does anyone do their best? Well, we don't do it. But what percentage of your time must you do your best? 80% of the time? 90%? You see, it's totally subjective and arbitrary. At the end of the day, none of those systems really provide any assurance whatsoever. The paradigm shift here is the realization that your best will not suffice, and that the point of comparison is not other human beings, but Jesus Christ. If you want to see God's standards, you don't look at other people. You look at His Son. That's His standard. And now, all of a sudden, those relative heights of the arrows becomes trivialized in comparison with the perfection of God's Son, which really is a manifestation of the perfection of the Father revealed on earth. That standard's so high that it is impossible of attainment. And once we have that shift where we come to understand the sinfulness of sin and the holiness of God, that's the shift that's made. That's why the Spirit of God, John 16, convicts the world of three things. What are the three things He convicts the world of? Remember, it's sin, righteousness, and judgment. Without the convicting of the Spirit, no one will come to an awareness of their true condition before God, namely their sin. They'll rationalize, they'll justify their position. Secondly, righteousness, the righteousness that God requires. I've often told you this, but I'll repeat it again because eventually you're going to learn it. If I repeat it again. I want you to listen carefully to these words. Are you ready for this? It's a little early in the morning, but the righteousness that God requires is that righteousness which His righteousness requires Him to require. Did you all hear it? Shall I say that again? The righteousness that God requires is that righteousness which His righteousness requires Him to require, which being interpreted as God cannot grade on a curve, because His righteousness requires Him to require perfection. And if he accepts something less than perfection, he's not God, because he's now living in fellowship with that which is incompatible with His nature. And sin can be defined as anything that is incompatible with the character of God, and God will not compromise. That's why He never, never, never forgives sin. He can only forgive sinners. Either Jesus bears the price by which, that is to say, you acknowledge that and receive His gift, or you pay the price yourself, but God is not mocked. This is a moral and spiritual world. And though it seems that people can get away with all kinds of injustices in this world, as we well know, the story is not over yet. And there is, in fact, a judgment that comes. Any questions on that idea? Because I'm going to move on into my paradigm shift. Yeah.
Using your optical illusion analogy, the fact that once you see the cow, you can't not see the cow. And we have now seen the grace of God in our lives, but by 5 o'clock this afternoon when we hit rush hour traffic, perhaps 50% of us in this room will forget we're Christians.
That's correct. Most of us will forget that or live as if we were atheists. You would never acknowledge it, but you live as a practical atheist. That's why the cow paradigm, where once you see it, you can't see anything else, is not the kind of paradigm shift we're talking about. I'm talking about the kind of reversible ones, like an M.C. Escher's drawings, where it looks like it's going up, but then you realize it's also going down, and you can't see them both the same way, but you can shift back and forth. It's like the old woman and the young woman. I don't know if you've ever seen that one, or the duck and the rabbit. Now you see a duck, now you see a rabbit. But it can't be a rabbit and a duck at the same time. Whoop, whoop, whoop. And we're like ducks and rabbits. We go back and forth. At one point, you see it from an eternal perspective, and then suddenly you slip back into the old paradigm because it's so comfortable. We lived in it so much of our lives. And that's where I'm saying this is a reversible scenario. And that is why we are in a warfare. Wouldn't it be easy if you bought it and then that was it? It'd be great. But, you know, you wouldn't grow. You wouldn't be in a situation where we live in this fallen world. God's not removed all the Canaanites from the land. Remember, He said, I'm not removing all the Canaanites in order that you may learn warfare, so that I'll remove them only gradually, was the image there. So we are now in a battle, we are in a warfare, and this is not home. That's why I say this is not a living room on this earth. It is actually more like a gym where you're working out. You're not actually in a comfortable situation, not fully. So let me go on from there then. The competing paradigms I have in mind here now are going to be the temporal versus the eternal. We can live as if this world is all there is. That's what Dean's just been talking about. It's easy for us to flip in back into that model. This is it. Or we can view our earthly existence as a brief pilgrimage, which is designed to prepare you for eternity. You can see it one way, you can see it the other way. Sometimes we see that we realize that this is only a brief earthly sojourn. How quickly we forget that we are pilgrims, aliens, strangers, sojourners, and wayfarers along the way. How quickly we forget the brevity of life. Because we deceive ourselves into thinking that we have all the time in the world. We forget the reality that people around us are dying all the time. You go to a party and people say to you, "My word, you know, I haven't seen you in 10 years, 15 years." What do they say to you? "My, you're looking good, you know." Remember that thing on Saturday Night Live, Billy Crystal? He's mocking of Hernando Lamas there. He says, "You look marvelous." "I really mean it. You look marvelous. It's better to look good than to feel good. You know what I mean, darling? You really look marvelous." Well, frankly, you don't look marvelous. You see somebody after 15, 20 years and you look hideous. By comparison, let's be honest about it. All they mean is that you're preserved well. You know, but you can see the obvious difference. In fact, it's depressing to see people that I hadn't seen in 20 years because they look terrible. But I also realize I look terrible. You see the point here? And if you base your hope on that, on the supposition that you're going to live forever, that is a very, very thin basis for any kind of warrant for life, for meaning, for purpose, for hope, for destiny. None of that will work. Now, I want to say the men and women in Hebrews 11, that great chapter of faith, embraced the perspective of the eternal being more valuable than the temporal. That it is the eternal that gives meaning to the temporal. It's not that you're going to become so heavenly minded that you're no earthly good. Actually, the more heavenly minded you are, the more you treasure the opportunities of this fleeting world. You see the difference? You actually will become more relevant in your sojourn, more alive to the present opportunities, not less. If you really grasp the implications of this, they're huge. It says, all these died in faith, Hebrews 11, 13. This is a wonderful verse. Speaking of these great men and women of the Old Testament, all these died in faith without receiving the promises. None of them got the promises. Remember, Abraham was looking for a city whose architect and builder is God? He's not home yet, and you're not going to be home in this world. So they never received the promises in this life, but they died in faith. But having seen them and having welcomed them from a distance, they confessed that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. Do you see the perspective? They saw them at a distance, and they welcomed them at a distance, but they confessed, on this earth, I'm never going to embrace the promises. Because my hope must not be in the transitional promises of this world, the temporal promises, but it must be in the eternal promises of God, and that is where my home will be. It's Hebrews 11, 13. So my last thought here is this. Those who adopt a temporal paradigm, temporal, just an earthly orientation, treat the temporal as though it were eternal, and the eternal as though it were temporal. If you embrace a biblical paradigm, you will treat the temporal as such, as temporal. You'll hold the things in this world with a loose grip. And you will treat the eternal as eternal by putting your heart and all the freight of your hopes and aspirations in the promises of God.
To order additional copies of this CD or other selections from Ken Boa's teachings, call 800-DRAW-NEAR. That's 800-372-9632. Or contact us through the Reflections Ministries website at www.reflectionsministries.org.